This is Remembering Yugoslavia, the show exploring the memory of a country that no longer exists. I'm your guide, Peter Korchnak. The question I hear most frequently is why? Why am I, a person not from the former Yugoslavia, dedicating my time and treasure to a place I don't know, with the podcast, the writing, the photography? Why Yugoslavia? There is no single or simple answer. The Y is a river comprised of many tributaries, inflowing at different times and different places, from my childhood in Czechoslovakia to my new life between the US and the former Yugoslavia, from film to people, from dreaming to writing. I talk about some of these tributaries in the origin story of Remembering Yugoslavia in episode 3. A major one was the exploration of Yugoslavia's and my native Czechoslovakia's dissolutions during my graduate studies at Central European University. There is another major contributing tributary that after about a decade-long hiatus carried me back to Yugoslavia. On Friday the 13th, 2012, I went to the Atlantis Lounge in Portland, Oregon to see the local Balkan brass band Krepsic Orkestar. The frontman, Alex Krebs, who save for his Bosnian wife has no connection to the Balkans, sported a fez and a fake gold tooth and taught the crowd to paste dollar bills onto the musicians' glistening foreheads. Shot glasses clanked again and again, and late into the party, a group of raucous Serbs carried a drunk birthday boy named Zlaya around the room in a chair. Many questions burned like rakia through my chest that night, but the one that ended up bringing me to this point was, why am I nostalgic? It took 300 years for nostalgia to morph from a disorder to a helpful emotion. In his seminal work Yearning for Yesterday, published in 1979, Fred Davis separated nostalgia from homesickness and defined it as a longing for the past. In the nostalgic experience, the discontents and anxieties of your life today triggered a yearning for the better times of yesteryear, yielding a positively toned evocation of a lived past. Another school of thought sees nostalgia primarily as a mourning for the past, and the bittersweet view defines nostalgia as a happy-ish emotion mixed with sadness for an irretrievably lost past. In any case, nostalgia acts as a psychological defense mechanism, memory with the pain removed. For about a decade after I moved to America, for love, I was wrapped in a cloak of shapeless gloom that became heavier as time passed. Nostalgia is a more precise term to describe the immigrant experience, writes the Romanian-born professor Andreea Dețiu-Ritibor. The Polish emigre Eva Hoffman speculates that exile is the archetypal condition of temporary lives. Indeed, it is of our entire Western civilization since the expulsion from paradise. I was doubly exiled, an immigrant to a country of immigrants, and a diasporan from a past country of perpetual diasporans. Nostalgia filled the gap between my past and present lives. The questions led me back to Yugoslavia, to traveling and seeking and writing, all the way to the very moment we are sharing right now. And the more I learned, the more the gloom lifted. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, red nostalgia gripped Central and Eastern Europe. Retrospection about the good life during state socialism helped people to cope with the dramatic and traumatic changes during transitions from socialism to capitalism, to channel discontent with their current situation, and to reconstruct their identity to replace the one demolished so effectively and so swiftly. Nostalgia flourished in that space between what had been and what was not yet in place. The former Yugoslavia was no exception. Yugonostalgia has come up time and again on the show. I've explored different facets of it with different guests, but it always felt like talking about a book without ever having read it. So today, I'm finally going to take a deep dive into Yugonostalgia. And because I'm from where I'm from, and with a nod to the good old times as a student, I'm going to do it in a comparative way, contrasting nostalgia in the former Yugoslavia with that in the former Czechoslovakia. As you'll hear, nostalgia has a future-forward dimension. So do the gifts good people from all over the world send my way to help keep the show going, and the memory of the former country alive. Thank you Alex, Ivana, Lisa, and Wendy for your contributions. I can't do this without you. If the podcast helps you process your own feelings, if it's therapeutic to you in some way, as I know it is to many, be like Alex, Ivana, Lisa, Wendy, and many other contributors and support the show today. You'll gain early access to extended and bonus episodes, but most importantly, to the knowledge you're helping to bridge the past and the present and the future of a place that once was, is, and will in a different form be again. Go to rememberingyugoslavia.com/donate or follow the link in the episode description in your podcast listening app and donate today.
There are so many different interpretations of what Yugoslavia is.
Milica Popović is a doctor of political sociology and Balkan studies from Belgrade. Born in 1982, she focuses on Yugonostalgia, particularly among her generation, the so-called last pioneers. She identifies as Yugoslav. She spoke with me from Vienna. Everyone has their own definition, or at least an opinion, of Yugonostalgia. It's like a vessel everyone fills with their own ideas. In the most general sense, collective nostalgia is a bittersweet emotion that reflects sentimental longing for valued aspects of the past of one's group. It is a multi-layered emotional story we tell ourselves of bygone, irretrievably lost times that were better than today. It is less about what was than about what is. The past is but a distorting, romanticized mirror to the present. Yugonostalgia, then, is a longing for positive aspects of socialist Yugoslavia. That is, not necessarily for the state or the regime or socialism per se, but rather, as Maja Maksimovic writes, for a certain mix of characteristics, values, and objects connected to that period, such as military strength, international reputation, economic welfare, prosperity, unity, solidarity, social security, friendship, cultural cooperation, geographical space, or even consumer products. It is oriented toward unfulfilled dreams, lost opportunities, and elusive ideals of the socialist Yugoslav past. In other words, it's about what people miss today rather than what they miss from yesterday. End quote. Interpretations of Yugonostalgia converge on these themes. An outlier is Anna Petrov, who has defined Yugonostalgia as a kind of love. Quote, if nostalgia was seen as a condition in which a person can suffer because of the loss of home, then Yugonostalgia appears to be a similar kind of contemporary post-socialist condition in which one can be madly in love with their homeland. The desire to return home is realized in loving what was left of Yugoslavia, the culture, the music, the people.
There are three main manifestations, so to say, of Yugonostalgia. One is, of course, the term used as a discursive strategy of the new nationalist neoliberal elites in the post-Yugoslav countries, which are trying to mark as negative any kind of reflection on the socialist Yugoslav times, whether that reflection is positive or even just neutral.
After 1991, simplistic discursive revisionism, where everything that came before was bad and everything that is now is good, aimed to legitimize the new ethno-national neoliberal regimes. This revisionism, which the late Dubravka Ugrasic called the confiscation of memory, still takes on a number of forms. The erasure of or omitting to mention socialist heritage and its modernizing accomplishments in textbooks, museums, or the media. Presenting Yugoslavia as an aberrant and failed experiment. Renaming streets and public spaces. Damaging, demolishing, or removing monuments. Labeling the regime as totalitarian. Being from one of the most repressive regimes in the Soviet bloc, I find this particularly insulting. Equating partisans and chetniks as anti-fascists, calling Yugoslavia the prison of nations, and the label Yugonostalgic used to mark adherents to the old order, who are seen as reactionary losers and immoral traitors and enemies of the new order.
The term itself, Yugonostalgia, showed up for the first time in 1992 in the weekly Globus in Hrvatska. It was a term coined by Slaven Letica, a journalist, and in an article published under the title Croatian Feminists Rape Croatia. And it was a direct attack on five Croatian novelists, activists, among which was late Dubravka Ugrasic that we have to mention, and one of the people who truly also inspired my work and who has recently deceased. So the term Yugonostalgia was coined with a clear mission to denigrate and to erase anything, any serious discussion, dialogue, reflection on the socialist Yugoslav times.
Yugonostalgia connotes all non-negative references to Yugoslavia. This is how, for example, an article about this podcast labeled it Yugonostalgic, even though it is anything but, or why I've been called Yugonostalgic merely because I sometimes listen to Yugoslav-era rock from the 1980s. There are surprisingly few polls across the former Yugoslavia tracking people's perception of that disappeared country and its breakup. A 2016 survey by Gallup showed that perceptions regarding Yugoslavia's breakup vary by former republic, ethnicity, and age. Perhaps as could be expected, the citizens of Serbia, politically dominant in the former Yugoslavia, rue Yugoslavia's demise the most, at 81%, and Croatia's and Kosovo's the least, at 23% and 10% respectively. Also, as can be expected, older people of near retirement and retirement age feel the most harmed by the country's breakup. This and other polls and research reflect a sense of loss among the citizens of the former Yugoslavia. It's only a short road from here to nostalgia and to labeling all those wounded souls Yugonostalgic. After Yugoslavia's disintegration, even the name of the old country was erased. Broadly, Yugoslavia turned into Southeast Europe, turned into Western Balkans. And of course, it's always the region, or naši or ovi prostori, our spaces, these areas.
And then the second kind of manifestation of yugonostalgia is the moment where yugonostalgia becomes this very intimate container for all the cognitive dissonances of people who still remember Yugoslavia, for all the ambivalent, ambiguous kind of positions towards the socialist Yugoslav past, and the very positive ones which are in direct conflict with the mainstream hegemonic memory narratives on Yugoslavia.
Yugonostalgia can be subjective, experienced on the level of individual memories and recollections, and collective or cultural, manifesting in images, symbols, products, events, and so on in the public space. The two often overlap. People attend the Day of the Republic or Day of Youth commemorations, dance at XU parties, listen to Jugorock, wear apparel with socialist symbols or even Tito himself, frequent Yugo-themed cafes. Svetlana Boim distinguished between two types of nostalgia. Reflective nostalgia is all about the longing for the lost home and time. It is wistful, it plays with the past as it processes it, and it brings it forth in a critical, comparative fashion. It can be ironic and humorous, as when people dress up in pioneer uniforms. The vast majority of Yugonostalgics feel reflective nostalgia. Restorative nostalgia seeks to recreate and reconquer the lost homeland and era. It's serious, it knows the past, and it aims to reconstruct it in the present day. Like the Trumpsters in the US, the nationalists across the post-Yugoslav space all feel restorative nostalgia.
And then the third manifestation would be, how does it become this resistance strategy in the political field? Which is this point where Yugonostalgia, from all the potential of being a resistance strategy that many of authors before me have reflected upon, as Mitya Veliko, Natan Petrovic, I think a lot of people have already participated in the podcast, and how does it actually really translate into political activity?
Mitya Velikonia distinguishes between passive and active nostalgia. The first type is apolitical, asocial, contemplative, sentimental, melodramatic, inert, introspective, with practically no social ambitions or impact whatsoever. Passive nostalgia is consumerist, for example, by reviving old brands, say Bayadera or Kokta, aestheticized and objectified with retro and vintage stuff, memorabilia, or museum exhibitions. Popularized through festivals, exhibitions, and other events, infantilized, reduced to stories from childhood and youth, spectacularized by highlighting major past achievements, say in sports, as well as banalized, focusing on small everyday details of life back then. By contrast, active nostalgia uses the past to antagonize the present. It is involved in political and social movements, it is concerned with the idea of a different future, and is fighting for it. Active Yugonostalgia is first a counter-narrative, a counter-memory, a subversive resistance strategy expressed in opposition to ethno-nationalism and neoliberalism dominating the political and media landscapes. It defends the past, this is the present, and in a way describes the future. To paraphrase Velikonia, where passive nostalgia makes for teary eyes, active nostalgia enables people to raise a clenched fist. It is precisely through this political dimension, writes Popovic, that we can identify the nature of nostalgia. It is the politics of Yugonostalgia that enables its classification, indeed this very podcast episode. Now in Slovakia, things are similar but not as complex. That complexity, by the way, is a major reason why I study Yugoslavia, not my own Czechoslovakia.
The second half of the 70s, or actually the 70s and 80s, was a period of relative improvement of well-being that could be visible through automatic washing machines, more modern refrigerators, more modern cars.
Boris Strečanský is from Bratislava. He works in the civil society and public management sector in Slovakia as a trainer, evaluator, and consultant, and writes on these topics as well. He was born in 1967 and spoke with me from Tbilisi, Georgia.
All of these items that I mentioned, they were, of course, not in sufficient quantity. So there have been all these queues and lines, and it was not easy to get hold of them or to buy them. But still, this was kind of the period of, I'm talking now specifically about Slovakia, that was experiencing some kind of a benefit of economic growth. That experience probably was different in Czech Republic, which probably has not been growing so much than Slovakia was.
Though my country was nowhere near as prosperous as Yugoslavia, particularly in the less economically developed Slovakia, socialism and the communist government's development and modernization policies brought a marked increase in the living standards. Traditionally, agricultural Slovakia had for centuries been a backward breadbasket province of Hungary, and thus was starting out from a low base. The Czech lands had a greater tradition of industry and a stronger economic starting point. Nostalgia for, at least positive evaluations of socialism, emerged quite soon after the Velvet Revolution of 1989 that brought regime change to Czechoslovakia. The rapid economic reforms benefited the country in the long run, but hurt a lot of people in the first few years, especially in Slovakia, where the heavy industries that were the hallmark of socialist development took a particular hit. We went from guaranteed jobs but empty shelves to unemployment and full stores in the space of months. Following a democratic and economic downturn in the 1990s, the new millennium brought rapid economic development, membership in the European Union, and other positives to Slovakia. A few years after I moved to the US, I noticed in my old country a surge of memory of socialism that lasted for about a decade. The movie Goodbye Lenin was still reverberating, social media was taking hold, the Great Recession was raging, and my fellow last pioneers were having children and rising in society's ranks. Forums, social media, magazines, and newspapers were flooded with pictures of cars and toys and snacks and other socialist-era products, as well as smuggled Western products. Reminiscences proliferated about how things were in those times, from school trips to young pioneer rituals to vacations in Bulgaria. Companies ran retro-themed marketing campaigns. Though this commodification was certainly nostalgic, unlike in Yugoslavia, it felt like a generation coming to terms with middle age coming at them. Still, every year on the anniversary of the Velvet Revolution, reflections on socialism filled the media. The semi-monthly show Noc v archive, A Night in the Archives, featuring pre-1989 television footage, has been a stalwart of Slovak television programming for 14 years running. Staré časy, or The Good Times, is the title of the 2019 collaborative song by Polemic and Mediel Banana. I'm playing it here for you with the bands and their labels' permissions. Follow them on social media and buy their music. All the links are at rememberingyugoslavia.com/podcast. In the song, the Slovak ska legend Polemic, established in 1988, and their reggae-loving Gen Z friends list things from the socialist childhood that they juxtapose against the present day. Remember those times we didn't have mobile phones and played football out on the grass? It begins. The chorus summarizes the generational feeling. We're there again, we remember everything, the same sun shines upon us today. We're still ourselves and we will put our hands into the fire for those old times that propel us forward. Pamätáš tie časy, keď nemali sme mobily a na travníku na futci sme čakávali hodiny a Lukáš nemal mangy, sme počúvali Walkmana, hokejky za chrbtom, rozdelenie bez mena, VHS kazety, diaky a mehotár, cvičky a úbor a samozrejme obedár, jelení loj a dermako na beďar, BMX-ka a prestičky na pedál.
Zelený až do tmy povešaný na prašákoch, uličky, bunkra, schovky, doma loptu bol za svorky. Hrali nové ity dookola z kazeťákov, na stenách posteli zbrava, už sme znova tam, všetko si pamätáme, to isté slnko svieti na nás aj dnes, stále sme to my, ruky do ohňa dáme, za staré časy, ktoré nás tlačia pre.
Vic, Perzie, Duke, Nukem, Wolfenstein, Komandos, Prehistorik a Half-Life, ABCčko, Bravo a Fifík, Kelly, Family a tatko ešte hippík. Polka už má trenky, ale polka furt slipy a pri skoku do ďalky sme kričali skipy. Dukatové buchtičky a čevapčiči, večera má ti z okna kričí.
Známky, prázdne plechovky, aj zbierka angličákov,
červené trenky, biele trička, telesná povinne v cvička.
Prvé tajné rande v letnom deň panelákov,
úlovky z nedelnej burzy, časáky, platne aj číslo burby.
Už sme znova tam, všetko si pamätáme, to isté slnko svieti na nás aj dnes, stále sme to my, ruky do ohňa dáme, za staré časy, ktoré nás páčia pre.
Náš bezstarostný plán, iba náš čas, čo patril iba nám.
Slnko klasikové názvačepe. Už sme znova tam, všetko si pamätáme. To isté slnko svieti na nás aj dnes. Stále sme to my, ruky do ohňa dáme. Za staré časy, ktoré názvačepe.
In 2018, a survey showed positive feelings for socialism to be quite persistent in Slovakia. 43% of respondents said life was better under socialism, with 20% saying it was much better. By contrast, only 32% thought they lived better lives now than in socialism.
Especially older respondents, so people who have, who are in their 50s or 60s and plus, they view the life in Czechoslovakia before 1989 as positive compared to a younger generation.
While only 18% of 18 to 24-year-olds thought life was better before 1989, 73% of over 65-year-olds thought so. Of course, those younger cohorts have no lived experience of socialism.
Most of these nostalgic feelings and sentiments are related to socioeconomic situation or so-called guarantees of certain socioeconomic status. Things like availability of housing or social security or support from the state or employment availability of jobs. So these kind of socioeconomic elements seem to play a major role in the nostalgic thinking.
The other dimension of discontent was social status during socialism. People who after 1989 declined along that dimension, say miners, steelworkers, other heavy industry labor, evaluate socialism more positively.
And there are also other elements of nostalgia that are less material. They are also more sentimental and romanticizing the life during those days, that viewed life in Czechoslovakia as being more moral, in a sense that people were more inclined to help each other, or that they were like more closer to each other, kind of a sense of community or a sense of mutuality. That's something which we can say objectively exists in minds of people. And I think that's really something that also influences current politics to some extent. But one thing that I think we should perhaps look in a greater detail or ask a question, to what extent is this, or whether this is a nostalgia for the regime and all those functions that the regime provided, or is this nostalgia for a country? This seems to be a nostalgia not for Czechoslovakia as a state. This is more a nostalgia for a type of a state or a kind of a state or a kind of a regime that Czechoslovakia embodies in minds of people today.
There's no such thing as a Czechoslovako nostalgia, a nostalgia for the country like there is in the former Yugoslavia. Certainly, Yugo nostalgia blends feelings for the country with feelings for socialism, for the kind of a country that Yugoslavia was, and the two are hard to distinguish. But there were aspects of Yugoslavia without socialism that people value. By contrast, in the case of my homeland, the country and socialism are pretty much indistinguishable. And so whereas surveys in the former Yugoslavia ask about the country, polls in the former Czechoslovakia inquire about the system. Negative evaluation of post-1989 capitalism and positive evaluation of socialism has been on the increase in my former country. A survey in 2009 found that 68% of Czechs and 53% of Slovaks thought the current regime was better. In 2021, those figures declined to 58% of Czechs versus 45% of Slovaks who thought the current regime was better than socialism. What people remember, the content of nostalgia, does indeed depend on a few factors. First, their generation. There's a reason why I ask every guest to state their year they were born.
As every memory narrative, different generations have different stories and different memories. So for every generation, there was, so to say, a different Yugoslavia to remember.
Popovic explored Yugonostalgia on the generation of the last pioneers, people like herself, born between 1974 and 1982. I fall into that demographic too, though in the former Czechoslovakia, we were called Husák's children, after the president of the republic at the time. Generation here stands to mean a cohort of people with certain collective identity marked by participation and socialization in the same events and realities that formed their identity. For the last pioneers, it was the pioneer oath and various rituals imparting the values of brotherhood and unity. But I could also add 80s music or the Wars of Dissolution to this. They see themselves as a lost generation who helplessly watched their world go down in flames and are still sorting through the wreckage. Popovich found a cohort commonly remembering happy, ethnic identity-free childhoods in a diverse country with a beautiful sea, life in a safe, secure, relatively abundant, and reasonably well-functioning state that was their home. They shared values of solidarity, anti-materialism, meritocracy, modesty, freedom, critical thinking, social equality and justice, brotherhood and unity, anti-fascism, and women's emancipation. These were the things they learned while living in Yugoslavia.
They were referring to Yugonostalgia as just sadness for a normal life, and that there is nothing political in it. But the way I kind of see it, it was truly how political the definition of what a normal life is and what a normal life constitutes is fundamentally the way we think as political beings, because the way we understand which elements need to be satisfied for us to consider our life normals are actually where we stand on the political spectrum.
Popovich found that the last pioneers, and this may be the case for all of us, think of normality through a political lens. Access to education and healthcare, freedom to travel abroad, solidarity and equality and druženje, socializing across borders, peace and stability, owning a house and a summer home, indeed having a chance in life that they had during Yugoslavia is what normality still means to them. They're not Yugonostalgic, they just want a normal life.
One of the interviewees said, well, actually, Yugonostalgia doesn't exist. Yugonostalgia is what they say you are doing only when you start talking about a decent healthcare system or a decent housing system. And I think that it's really the generation of the last pioneers who's going to be able to kind of break the pattern and at least bring additional ideas to the fore in the political arenas of the post-Yugoslav countries.
The last pioneers' Yugonostalgic memory is anti-nationalist, in opposition to the dominant discourse in their countries, and strongly favoring socioeconomic equality. They're against neoliberalism and its capitalist excesses. In fact, their Yugoslav identities often don't even contain Yugoslavia, past or potentially resurrected. They simply bring portions of their old identities from that time and place into today's context. They simply don't want who they are and where they're from to be erased. They wanted recognized Yugoslavia existed and had both positive and negative sides. Their country did not disappear, but rather it's a ruin. They embed their Yugonostalgia, the memory and idea how things were, in the present as how things can be done better or how can they be once again. Less nostalgia for the past and more borrowing from the past in search of solutions to the problems of the present. As Popovich puts it in her dissertation, this generation transforms the memory of the Yugoslav cause into a memory of a post-Yugoslav cause, bringing back the idea of progress and hope into the political field of post-Yugoslavia. And if the right wing sees the world divided into ethno-national states, the left favors an international world brought together around a set of ideas they know from that former country. In addition to the generational dimension, Yugonostalgia's other dimension is political.
Especially the question of certain types of Yugoslavism, the Yugoslav identity, were much more connected to the generational positionality. And then, of course, especially the Yugonostalgia as a resistance strategy, the serious reflections about the socialist Yugoslav system is, of course, more embedded in the political positionality as such. Especially when we were discussing the childhood of the last pioneers, 100% of the interviewees have depicted a happy childhood, and through that, a very positive image of socialist Yugoslavia. And only in the moment when we would start discussing the war years and the dissolution years, where the cognitive dissonances would appear, especially in the cases where the political positionality was actually primarily negative towards the socialist past, the interviewees from the right-wing spectrum would start finding various discursive strategies to reconcile these opposing, so to say, narratives. One of the strategies was kind of keeping Yugonostalgia as this very intimate feeling and sentiment. For example, people would say, yeah, but you know, actually the repression was horrendous, but it was just me and I was lucky and my family was lucky that we didn't experience it.
If generation and political orientation were the two main factors behind the content of Yugonostalgia, where people were from, that is what successor country they lived in, mattered much less. Popovich's Croatian, Serbian and Slovenian subjects showed similar generational and political characteristics.
What I wanted to underline as well was that actually these memories on childhood in the narratives were always strongly connected also with social and political values. So it wasn't the fact that these childhoods were happy because those were the childhoods. They were, in the interpretation of my interviewees, happy because those were the childhoods in socialist Yugoslavia. And that is a very important distinction to make.
In the case of Czechoslovakia, the Republic does matter, as you've already heard. Czechia had a greater tradition and historical memory of democracy from the interwar period and declined during socialism relative to Slovakia, which improved markedly. At the same time, in the Czech Republic, the Communist Party was in parliament until 2021, while its Slovak counterpart only 4 of the country's 30 independent years. Go figure. In Slovakia,
it is really the socioeconomic grievances that part of the population perceives as very important in their day-to-day life that contribute to and they nurture these nostalgic feelings. But if you look at Slovak economic development over the last 30 years, we can see that it has gone through, of course, difficult periods in the 90s. But then after the turbulent 90s, Slovakia got on the track towards the European Union integration and also jumped on the train of its economic reforms, which led to a significant growth, economic growth. So then there comes the question, how is it possible that the significant proportion of people perceives socioeconomic grievances as very important? Does this mean that the economic growth did not precipitate to the population? And probably the answer is to some extent yes, but also the answer is that part of these socioeconomic grievances are more on the level of perceptions than a reality. Now, let me explain that. Slovakia is one of the most economically equal countries in Europe or in OECD, measuring by the Gini index that measures the income inequality.
Slovakia was the only post-communist country where inequality decreased in the early 1990s. Yes, inequality in Slovakia was actually higher during socialism, with incomes and perks linked to party privileges, the black market, and hidden unemployment, while the ideals of equality were promoted through coercion and especially propaganda. Coming out of socialism, people remembered the regime as more egalitarian than it actually was. And again, Slovakia continues to boast one of the lowest levels of inequality in the European Union.
However, for a significant parts of the population, the economic growth has not translated into them feeling perhaps more satisfied. So they can be objectively much better off than they were, but they still feel not satisfied. By this, I definitely don't want to disregard any growing socioeconomic inequalities that Slovakia has been experiencing and is experiencing even today. There are severe pockets of poverty, especially of Roma population that lives in terrible conditions, but also parts of population that is somehow disadvantaged by their family status, for example, single-parent families with multiple children or single-living seniors. So to some extent, it's not surprising that the socioeconomic factors do contribute towards nostalgia, but it seems that it's a combination of a true socioeconomic status factor and a perception factor.
It is perceptions or perhaps misperceptions of present inequality that drive nostalgia for socialism. Additionally, the Slovak national character is quite egalitarian, with corresponding social and peer pressure. We notice and judge negatively people who stand out, so displays of wealth, even if they're rare or minor, like a fancy car, are likely to generate an excessive opposite response. Cut off his head so he doesn't stick above the crowd, as the old song goes. And then there's the tendency to draw what we call a thick line between the past and the present. That was then, now is now.
When the Velvet Revolution and when the change of the regime was happening, that actually meant also a opening up of Pandora box of different ideas and different expressions. And in this Pandora box, there were also expressions of identity, of Slovak identity. What is Slovak identity and what it is not? And these expressions have been suppressed by the regime. So the rejection of the socialism in 1989 basically meant also a renewed nationalism in Slovak context.
These new or revived and often mythologized ideas about the country's history found fertile ground in the collective mindset emerging from 40 years of brainwashing.
Basically, communist interpretation of Slovak history was not taken as true. I mean, it was something like like the noise of the leaves in the forest. I mean, it was everywhere, but people were not paying attention to it. So the historical awareness of Slovaks had basically a very little opportunity to be cultivated and to somehow be more resistant to lurings of different ideologized or somehow manipulated views of history, especially the 70s and 80s, as I remember it. You know, nobody believed what was being written in the newspapers, what was written in the history textbooks. I mean, it was kind of ornamentalism, you know, of everyday life, but it did not have a substance. The nature of investigation of history and study of history was completely deformed, and the historical consciousness of people who lived in Slovakia then has been deformed by these tilted narratives that the communist regime tried to implant into people's minds. The mind of the public was not very, I would say, well prepared to understand and to critically deal with these newly implanted ethno-nationalist ideas that were fueling the public space in early 90s. And if we look at the socialist period in Slovakia since 1948 until 1989 and its reflection, we don't see much of interest in looking at this period. Basically, during the 90s or early 2000s, there is not much of reflection of that period. There is generally very little of interest in critically reviewing and reflecting either modern history or the older history. It's kind of a neglect to the history as such, and that then creates a fertile soil to implant any kinds of misperceptions in people's minds.
The same things that allowed nationalism to thrive made space for nostalgia to manifest. Democracy allowed for the free expression of various opinions, and availability of information via the media, and especially the internet, created ample ideological space. Nationalists in Slovakia did not rest on historic memory, and independence did not enjoy mass support. In fact, the country's dissolution was executed by political agreement. There was no referendum. They were just louder and smarter, and joined by turncoat communists with accumulated social and financial capital and adept at navigating the power structures. In the Czech part of the former federation, the narrative that prevailed was the continuity of national culture irrespective of political regimes, as Veronika Pehe puts it in her book on the subject. Unlike Slovakia, whose peoples as a nation weren't quote-unquote invented until the mid-19th century, the Czechs have a centuries-long history of independent statehood as pre-Habsburg kingdoms. In this context, socialism was just a historical blip. The Czechs dealt with socialism through extensive public discussion about the former regime, with anti-communism as a major narrative, implying it was them, the communists, who were ruling us, the ordinary Czech people. The Czechs' nostalgia goes beyond a simple victimhood narrative, however. Their nostalgia focuses rather on dissent and resistance during the socialist period, thusly perhaps harking back to the persistence of the Czech character through any and all circumstance. Socialism gets dismissed as aberrant and evil, the Czechs absolved of responsibility for it, and the return to democracy hailed as a regression to the mean. In pop culture, particularly movies, even in their critical treatment of the former regime and its downsides, pushed forward an aesthetic, often ironic appreciation of the socialist past and the form of retro. In Slovakia, film played a minimal role in memory politics for the first 20 or so years after socialism. Finally, the legal processes. Restitution returned to original owners the properties confiscated by the socialist state, and through the process of lustration, communist secret police collaborators were publicly disclosed and barred from public life. Anniversaries of the Velvet Revolution tended to be about celebrating the now rather than reminding of the then.
There is, of course, a lot of mix-up with different other terms. Very often, also, Yugoslavism was kind of mixed with what we call Jugendnostalgia. So in a way, my research wanted to give back the legitimacy to Yugoslavism and to claim that Yugoslavism is still an empiric phenomenon which exists in the post-Yugoslav space and is different, even if interconnected, to Yugonostalgia as such.
Yugoslavism is contained within Yugonostalgia. It is based on linguistic, cultural, and economic proximity of the Slavic peoples in the former Yugoslavia. It is non-exclusive. You can be both Serbian and Yugoslav or Croatian and Yugoslav. It's both multi-ethnic and anti-nationalist. Though its supranational nature does not look too kindly on ethno-nationalism, it's compatible, if not parallel, with other identities. And it is non-oppositional. It lacks a resistance element. You can be a Yugoslav anti-communist or an Orthodox Yugoslav.
There might not be anything nostalgic about Yugoslavia, but there is a set of important values that socialist Yugoslavia brings upon, and that's anti-fascism, internationalism, solidarity, and socialism.
The political and social identity of the last pioneers, especially the left-wing ones, was built on their childhoods in Yugoslavia and as a response to post-Yugoslav ethno-nationalism and neoliberalism. And if that's the case for people who only spent their childhoods in Yugoslavia, I can only imagine what people who spent most of their lives during that period must think and believe.
Different people are nostalgic for different things, but what all the interviewees agree upon, and I am afraid not only the interviewees, I think that anyone who works in the post-Yugoslav region knows that this is a widespread sentiment, is actually the negative present. All the memories, all the memory narratives are always in dialogue, in reflection to our everyday present. And in a way, our memories are a response to what we are experiencing in present times. So in that sense, the memory narratives that we create and the identities we base on our memory narratives of being Yugoslav or of being grown up in the socialist Yugoslav times are also a sort of an answer to what has followed. So I truly felt that somehow this generation in between, the generation of the last pioneers, was in a certain way forgotten. And that was the generation that was born in Yugoslav times, that gave the pioneer sermon. And when they started and entered their adolescence, their whole world crumbled. Everything changed. There was the dissolution of the country, the war trauma. So for a very long period of time, they were growing into the adulthood through these very tumultuous times. They were children. They were not truly understanding what was happening. And as one of the interviewees said, that there was a rupture of her becoming from a bourgeois princess. She became a refugee. And just about when the wars ended, it was time for them to actually enter the socioeconomic world and to enter the political world. But at the same time, also being faced with the absolutely catastrophic consequences of the newly created nationalist regimes and the neoliberal transitions in which today's post-Yugoslav countries live in. So I think that the fact, and on a much global scale, the moment when it has been proclaimed that there is only one possible world in which we can live in, that was the moment when actually the world truly did became totalitarian and erased the hope for any different futures to the humankind. And that was the moment where the past has started to provide the only inspiration and hope for something better.
There is no such thing as Czechoslovakism today, but the two former countries do maintain a number of cultural connections, if not share a common cultural space. As during the common state, the flow is much stronger from the Czech to the Slovak lands, partly because of historical reasons, but also market size. Czechia is twice as large as Slovakia in terms of population. 1 in 5 books sold in Slovakia is in the Czech language, while only 6% of all translations on the Czech market are from the Slovak language. Thousands of Slovaks move to Prague and Brno for university studies and often stay. And the first foreign trip of each country's president is to the other part of the former federation. Last year, a big article came out in The Guardian with the headline, "Everyone Loved Each Other, The Rise of Yugonostalgia." I was interviewed for that piece. The reporter did not pick the headline, which was toned down in the print edition to Unity and Brotherhood, 30 years from its disintegration, many hold affection for Tito's state. Yugonostalgia may indeed continue to fascinate Western observers, including The Guardian's editors, who in classic Western gaze fashion quote-unquote discover it years after its peak. From taboo to subversion to culture to commodity, the narratives of Yugonostalgia and of Yugoslavia as its subject continue to evolve.
What do you see as the future of this phenomenon?
I think on one side, there is, or at least I hope, going to be a growing body of brilliant research on socialist Yugoslav times. And I think that that's going to help us elucidate the complexity of what socialist Yugoslav society has been. In the political field, what is really important is exactly this shift of generations, the moment in which last generations are taking up more and more space. A lot of people who were, for example, in 2017, 2018, when I interviewed them, at the time, they were maybe just members of parliament, simple members in their political parties, in the meantime have came to the leadership positions within their political parties. A number of social movements within which I have interviewed people have transformed into the political parties, which in some instances have won the municipal or city elections or have won some seats in the parliament. So this is also definitely changing the landscape in a certain way. And I think that it changes then and provides different angles to the mainstream discourses as such. But I think that what is also very, very important to kind of understand is how much of these reflections on the socialist Yugoslav times open avenues for different reflections on the new geopolitical structural changes, or we can call them even geopolitical earthquakes that we are currently living in.
As generations turn over, people who spent a greater portion of their lives in socialist Yugoslavia die out, and with them Yugonostalgia, of their kind anyway. For every claim of Yugonostalgia rising, there are plenty more that show Yugonostalgia to be fading. While Yugonostalgia has been with us since the late 1990s, in my estimation it reached its peak in the years after the Great Recession and has since been steadily integrating into the sociocultural fabric. And what's generally labeled as Yugonostalgia is in fact a minor part of Yugoslavia's memory. Different people assess that vanished country with different lenses and different goals, from political to commercial ones, while the rose-colored, warm and fuzzy feelings are both in decline and receding into the background.
So I would say that it's not nostalgia, Yugonostalgia itself, that has evolved, but I would say that it was rather the generational change and evolution of societies as such, which helped us understand the multifacets of Yugonostalgia.
As you can hear in the Inspired by Yugoslavia episodes, Yugoslavia also continues, and I believe will continue, to inspire artistic as well as commercial projects, many of which will cross, span, or outright ignore the current national borders. And finally, the political aspect of Yugonostalgia will continue to find expression in fostering relations, if not solidarity, among the former Yugoslav nations. As Popovic puts it, nostalgia for the socialist Yugoslavia could persist as long as it takes for the myth of the Golden Age to become reality. Now in my homeland,
what we are seeing today in Slovakia is definitely a tendency to accept a more authoritarian type of government, even if democratic principles would have to be sacrificed. More and more people is willing to accept the strong hand. And of course, majority of those who believe that strong hand is the right one are from the parties which can be considered as promoting extreme or non-systemic, anti-systemic policies with proto-fascist orientation. After the pandemics period, which wasn't really handled well in Slovakia, many people are basically left with this dilemma that, okay, we don't really want politicians who cannot provide order. But on the other hand, then there are these politicians who are promising a strong hand and maybe not order, but state capture. Second is that these are also very strongly correlate with the views that are promoting some kind of intolerance attitudes, feature strong pro-Russian, pro-Putin attitudes, or hostility towards refugees, be it refugees whatever countries, but including Ukrainian refugees. These are some trends which are disturbing, and that they may draw on some of these grievances and that fuel this nostalgia. On the positive side, we are seeing maybe more attention is being paid recently to history education in schools. So there are some more positive signs that the younger generation is getting more and more aware of certain aspects of Slovak history that we're not proud of and that have been not very well explained. And the younger generation was rather agnostic about those. So maybe as lived memory is dying out, as the older generation is fading away, maybe there is some improvement on the institutional level, and the younger generation might be getting a little bit more insight into the past of its country and its nation.
Next on Remembering Yugoslavia.
There is a lot to know about women in Yugoslav cinema. Women most typically or most frequently appear in front of the camera, but the story is always a bit more complicated than that.
Let's go to the movies. Yugoslav and post-Yugoslav cinema is a rich, if underappreciated, source of cultural insight. On the next episode of Remembering Yugoslavia, we'll talk films, and also films from the former Yugoslavia and its successors. Tune in wherever you listen to podcasts, follow to make sure you don't miss out, and subscribe to support us. That's all for this episode of Remembering Yugoslavia. Thank you for listening. Find additional information, sources, links, embeds, and the transcript of this episode at rememberingyugoslavia.com/podcast. Are you feeling nostalgic, ready to take action? Contribute to Remembering Yugoslavia's future and make a donation now to support the podcast and me in making it. Visit rememberingyugoslavia.com/donate to contribute today. Outro music, courtesy of Robert Petrić. Additional music by Polemic and Medial Banana. Buy their music, and courtesy of the bands and Reggae Calling Records. The tracks The Balkan Night Train by Dieter van der Westen and Rainmaker by Petar Algic, licensed under Creative Commons. I am Petar Korchniak. Ciao!